Hi, everybody. My name is Edie Cartwright, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
I want to thank Harlan and Zan and Ty for picking me up at the airport. But first of all, I want to really acknowledge the great speaker last night and the speaker this morning and this afternoon. I think they've done a great job. I'm so nervous that, and I forgot to bring my control panties because my ass goes into convulsions, and you know, it's an indicator when God's going to kick in. It's coming any minute. But what I want to do is if you don't mind, I'd like to have everybody who's in their first year of sobriety, if you would just stand up. I really appreciate you doing that. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got here, I bought my clothes in a feed store. I wore Wrangler jeans, flannel shirts, 2 6-packs of beer, and forget you. And you know, it wasn't forget you, but I won't say the F word from the podium, I don't think. So I want to read something to you, and the people that stood up, I want to read something to you. Because when I got to you, I couldn't read. And it wasn't that I couldn't read, it was that I was told that I was so dumb and I had such a low IQ, I kind of believed it. I don't know about any of you, but I think we get told a lot of stuff that's really not true. And then we make it our truth. And if we're here long enough, we can really find our spirit and our essence, and we can become the person that God intended us to be. So I have this favorite page that I've fallen in love with in the last, I don't know, I've read it many times, but I really like it. It talks about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it talks about the people. And, you know, I really think that this page and this other page that I'm going to read really speak to the commitment that goes on in this conference. And it's out of the big book. It's called The Keys to the Kingdom. And it's page 310. It starts on the second paragraph. It says, "So, I went to Akron and also to Cleveland. I met more recovered alcoholics. I saw in these people a quality of peace and serenity that I knew I must have for myself. Not only were they at peace with themselves, but they were getting a kick out of life such as one seldom encounters, except in the very young. They seemed to have all the ingredients for successful living. Philosophy, faith, a sense of humor, they could laugh at themselves, clear-cut objectives, appreciation, most especially an appreciation and sympathetic understanding for the fellow man. Nothing in their life could precedence over their response to a call for help from an alcoholic in need. They would travel miles and stay up all night with someone they never laid eyes on before and think nothing of it. Far from expecting praise for their deeds, they claimed the performance a privilege and insisted that they inevitably receive more than they gave. Extraordinary people." And I want you to know, if you're new, you're sitting at tables with extraordinary people. And I'm going to read this last couple of paragraphs because it's my very favorite. It says, "The last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But also, I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experience with one another, and also sharing our mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings and without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There's no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach. That ache is gone and never need to return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted, and needed and loved. In return for the bottle and a hangover, we've been given the keys to the kingdom." I, I want you to know that if you, that's really, really the two favorite pages in that book for me. I mean, all of them are great pages, but, you know, I come from a long line of dope fiend alcoholics. I come from the kind of alcoholics that did not drink alcohol out of a glass with ice cubes and referred to it as a cocktail. No. People that I grew up with pulled it out from underneath the seat, cranked off the lid, took a big jug, you know, swig, and went, ah! I thought it was like a Mexican Indian thing. I found out later it was just a whiskey thing. I think you learn to mimic the people you grow up with. And, I just was one of those, you know, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I wasn't angry, I was full of hate. I had to graduate to anger. You know, I got here with a little bit of a bad attitude. I was not grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I actually got tricked into coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. My little brother, who's actually 6'5", got out of the VA hospital in San Francisco in 1979. Oh, I need to tell you my sobriety date. Was it on the paper? Of my list of things to do. Uh-oh, I already messed up. Don't you hate that? By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and Black Belt, really strong sponsorship. I've been clean and sober since July the 11th, 1983. Thank you. Sorry about that. Get a little bit off track. Just get a little bit off track, that's all. Well, my heart's starting to calm down here. I mean, you know, I can't tell you what a privilege it is to be with you. You know, there are so many people in my, you know, they don't say it much anymore, but they used to talk about, you know, somebody had to die for you to have your seat. And that was true in my life. You know, my mother was a crazy American Indian woman by the name of Henrietta Valdez. She rode Harleys when women didn't ride Harleys. You know, she drove the family crazy because after I was born, she had me a little leather pouch on the back of her back on a Harley. And, you know, and that was in 1955. My mother was not a typical gal. No, she wasn't. She was a raging alcoholic woman who I know that I inherited the characteristic of, as soon as they tell you you can't do it, I just have to. You know, my mother never made it to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know that if anybody ever suggested that she go to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I can tell you how my mom killed and shut down her pain. You know, in 1958, she walked to the end of the hall, sat down on the edge of the bed, and she took a gun and she shot and killed herself. And I was almost 4 years old, and I was the one that found her. So, from that moment on, my life took a drastic change. And because my mother married outside of her race, the Valdez family thought that the reason that my mother committed suicide wasn't that she committed suicide. They were, if you visit any of the Valdezes today, they'll tell you that my dad shot and killed my mom. My dad went to jail for shooting and killing my mom, but they didn't have enough evidence or whatever, I don't know. I mean, the bottom line is my dad didn't serve any time for killing my mom, but as you can imagine, it caused a lot of upset in the family, in a family that's full of alcoholics. So my father, being a raging alcoholic, thought he came up with a brilliant idea. He thought that what he should do is give us, my little brother and I, to my cousin Mary, who had lost her children for being an unfit mother. Yeah, that's alcoholic thinking. And so what happened is I was adopted by her then fifth husband. His name was Frank Roth. He was a sailor on the USS Midway out of Alameda, California. He went on his boat to go out to sea, and she took all his stuff and sold it. And we had an old Rambler, and we lived in that station wagon Rambler for about another 6 years on and off. And really what she did is she took my hand and she took my little brother's hand and she took us to the places that women alcoholic go, where they go. We see things we shouldn't have seen. We experience things we shouldn't have experienced. And I can tell you that if that's the life that you led before you got here as a child, that this is a place where you can get healed from that. You know, that woman considered herself a call girl. She was just an old whore. You know, when she shouldn't have charged, she didn't. And when she, you know, when she should have charged, she didn't. And when she shouldn't have, she did. So she'd go to jail. Yeah, she'd go to jail. She went to jail a lot. And in San Francisco, and we used to get put in holding homes. And so, you know, by the time I was 12 years old, I was like, had an attitude. I had a really bad attitude. You know, I had actually had an attitude when I was about 6. You know, I remember one time we were staying with these people in the low-income housing over in the Fillmore in San Francisco, and I don't know why, but I had this really bad habit of scraping gum off the ground, you know, that hadn't been chewed all the way, had a little chew left in it. I don't know why I did that. But, you know, I had this nickel one day, and I was scraping this gum, and there was this lady walking across the courtyard there. You know, let me tell you, when you grow up in that environment, you know who lives there and who doesn't. You know who are the junkies, you know who are the hookers. You know, it's like a jungle and a culture unto itself. And if you live there, you figure it out. And I saw this lady walk, kind of a chunky lady walking towards me with her nylons going she must be one of the government people, you know. And she walked up to me and she looked down at me and she said, "Little girl, why don't you take that nickel and go buy yourself some gum?" And I looked up at that lady and I said, "Because I want to chew this gum, that's why." If you're new, that's kind of how I worked, looked at the steps. I don't know how she did it, but she found this woman by the name of Jessie who was taking care of us at the time. And this woman just must have fell in love with me because she came down and she had my little Safeway suitcase and she goes, "You get to go home with me." And I said, "Oh, okay." And I remember going across a Bay Bridge from San Francisco to Oakland having a feeling about that. Like I had no value. Did they just give me away? Not that I didn't mind being given away, because they had a very strange routine in their house. They like had breakfast. She was married to a fireman. They took me to Disneyland. They got me Flintstone vitamins. They were the oddest people I'd ever met in my life. They actually, you know, I would have a bath. These really extraordinarily weird things that we never did. And, you know, I don't know how long we were there, that I was there, before Mary realized that she couldn't get any money unless I was in her possession. And so she came to this woman's house, and her name was Jerry. I don't know what her last name was. I can tell you I went back and tried to find her. I remember the day that Mary was coming, she was sitting in her living room and she was crying. And I remember going up to her and I grabbed her cheeks and I said, "Whatever you do, don't let her see you cry." Now, I don't know where you learn that, but I learned it. So what I want you to know is, if you're new, this is a place where I got to discover who Edie is. And I got to find out that, you know what, I tell everybody, I tell the people I sponsor, and I say it a lot, when you get here, you know, you find a sponsor, you work the steps, and you know what, you shoot for the moon and you land in the stars. You know, when I got to you, I was a mess. The sin was a mess. It was beyond a mess. I was really inappropriate. You know, I went to my first meeting in 1979 with my brother, who said, "You know, Edie, they've ordered me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't go unless a blood member takes me." I thought, well, that's a damn good rule. And your life's a mess. You know, he was So I went to my first meeting in the Central Valley. I was living in Merced, and we went to this, and I was really good. I didn't drink much that day. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I actually thought I was a drug addict, right? And at any rate, don't you just hate that? They hate it worse than I do because they're trying to find it to turn it off. It's okay. We know there's a heart transplant somewhere going on, and you're the guy that's going to do it. I don't know what the hell we did before cell phones. Shit, we were just unimportant. But I'm so bad, I just won't even take my phone to a meeting because I always forget to turn it off. I don't know what that's about. You know, it should have one of those. Someday they'll invent the thing where you walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the cell phone will know, and you can program it to shut itself off. Now, I don't know why someone has not invented one of those. At any rate, where was I?
Going to your first meeting.
Oh, I went to take my brother to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By God, yeah, okay. So I don't know about any of you, but I make stuff up. I just make it up. Just, you know, I'll walk into a room and look around. Okay, got it. Figured it out. Check out the people, look at their faces. Okay. So I went to my first meeting and I saw all those little slogans on the wall and they had that little sign-in sheet going around. I grew up in foster homes. I know what you're doing with that. I know what you're going to do with that. None of you would put your whole name on it. By God, I did. I signed in Edith Francis Cartwright. Because I knew you'd turn that into a social worker so she'd give you coffee. Now, I made all that up in the first 4 minutes of my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new and you think I've had a little difficulty about making up stuff that wasn't true, it's called contempt prior to investigation, I am guilty. So who do you think they called on first? Yeah, they called on Edith Francis Cartwright. And I put my arms around my brother and I pulled him close and I said, I am his blood sister. So I want you to know that he is here and it's okay for him to be here. Do you know the strange looks that I got? And of course, you know, I went on to tell them all about him. Thank God I've gotten into that other program that helps that a bit. And so after the meeting, you know what those ladies did? They gave me their phone number. For what? I don't know. I guess I'm supposed to report to them about him. But I was thinking that maybe they were thinking I was an alcoholic. I could not believe that. I just couldn't believe it. And the reason that I couldn't believe it is because, you know, I grew up with a woman alcoholic that did things that I will not share at meeting level. Will not share at meeting level. That I had tremendous shame over. When I was like 10 years old, I knew a couple of things. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to be a whore. And I didn't want to live in a car. I was goal-oriented. I knew, you know, and I want you to know that Mary, towards the end of her life, and she had a short life, was doing the labor camps in Watsonville, California. And she was all distended out here like that. And we lived above a Mexican bar. And we had a box springs and some artichoke crates, and that's what we called home. And in the morning, I used to give her Carlo Rossi wine to take the sick off of her. I knew an awful lot about alcoholism way before I ever got to you. I just didn't know that's what it was. I want you to know that somehow she got a hold of my birth father, who I hadn't seen in many, many years. My dad gave me a pack of Lifesavers and double mint gum and told me, I'll be back in 45 minutes. And I stood on this porch in Hayward, California for probably 3 hours before they made me go inside. So I had a little disappointment around my dad, can you imagine? I'm like 12 years old and they give him a call and somehow he came and he picked us up at that sleazy little bar in Watsonville. And I was not really a very festive child. I was angry, and I was angry at him. Now, he was married to a woman from Houston, Texas, who hated Mexicans. I told him, I'm not all Mexican. You know, it's the first time we ever had dinner in their fancy home. They had this white bread, thick white bread. Well, I just took a piece of that white bread and made me a tortilla. So I could eat my food. You know, like tear off a piece and dive off into the middle of it. And, you know, that's how I knew how to eat. She freaked out. She said, oh my God, you're eating like a heathen Mexican at my table. You're never going to go to the top of the mark. Now I don't know where the hell the top of the mark is, but I'm not going. And I was never allowed to eat at the dinner table with them again. And I want you to know I was a great alcoholic because I made sure that every time in her presence, that any time I was eating anything that resembled food, I ate like a heathen Mexican because I did not want to disappoint old Catherine. I was there about 3 weeks, and she told me that my dad just felt sorry for my mom, that she got knocked up by some Marine. And I said, well, I'm glad to hear that, because maybe I've got a dad that has some balls somewhere. I know, that's an awful way for a kid to talk, but it upset her horribly, too. But, oh, God, did it make my day. But she was the kind of alcoholic that hid her vodka bottle in the toilet tank. They were the kind of alcoholics that drank alcohol in glasses with ice cubes and referred to them as cocktails. And, you know, my little brother had this dream that when we went to live with them that life would be different. And it wasn't different, because alcoholism is alcoholism, and it's in the home. It doesn't matter if it's in glasses or if it's just out of the bottle. And I came home one day from school, and which I didn't do well in school, if you can imagine. And there was Catherine on the kitchen floor, flopping around like a carp out of water. Just, I knew what it was because I'd seen Mary do it, right? And I called the police. I knew what to do. I called the police, and they came and got her. She was having alcoholic convulsions. You know what I want you to know is, Three months before that, I found Catherine. We got the word that Mary had died. Mary died in that hotel room in Watsonville, California, when she was 33 years old. Her esophagus ruptured, and she was dead in that hotel room for 3 days before anybody found her. So I knew a lot about alcoholism before I got to you. I knew what it was like to grow up in it. And I knew what it was like once I took my first drink I was like 10 or 11 years old. They were at a bar. I don't know if, you know, Mary drinks at those kind of bars that I loved to drink in when I started, you know, when I got those kind that, you know, you can smell two blocks away, you know, and she would go into the bar and she'd say, we'll be right back. And about 3 hours later, 4 hours later, they show up with a bottle of Coke and a bag of peanuts. That's called dinner. Right? And then after about 4 or 5 hours, they have you lay down in those cars because they don't want the authorities to see you. And I don't know why this night was any different, but I reached underneath that seat and I found that bottle of Sigram 7. And you know, it had like this much in it, and I cranked off that lid and I took my first drink of alcohol. I kicked it back and I guzzled it down and I went just like they always did. You know, I went, and you know, my ears popped, I was running out of my eyes were burning, and I was just like hanging on to the steering wheel and saying, oh my God, no wonder they make that awful sound. But if you're an alcoholic like my type, you know what happened is that magic. Man, I felt it burn all the way down, and when it got to my belly, it just went, whoa. And man, the first time in my life, I didn't care. I loved the way alcohol made me feel, because when I had alcohol in me, I didn't feel nothing, and it felt great. I didn't feel mad, I didn't feel sad, I didn't feel dumb, I just felt just right, because I'm an alcoholic, and that's what alcohol does to me. And I also found out that alcohol, if you have alcohol, which is more readily available than food, if you drink enough alcohol, you don't get hungry. So, you know, it killed two birds with one stone. Took away the feelings and took away the hunger. I thought it was a magical thing. So, I'm in San Jose, and Jesus Christ, how old am I?
29.
Jesus Christ. I'm 12 years old. I'm 52. We got a long ways to go. Yep. 52. I'm 12. I only have 20 more minutes. Oh, what the hell. I guess I'm just going to give you an Alateen talk here. Don't you just love this? Oh, God, you know, I got on my knees in front of a toilet because that's where I do my best praying. You know, and I just asked God to be a channel of His grace and allow me to get out of the way. So isn't it interesting what God's telling you tonight? At any rate, I need to get at least to 20. You know, when I was 50 years old, you know what I bought myself? I bought myself a Harley. Yeah. I didn't buy just any Harley. I bought a Harley that Henrietta would be proud of. And I'm actually getting a license plate this year that says Hank. I'm naming my motorcycle after my mother. Yeah, I got a Road King Classic. Yeah, I got a big motorcycle, and you know, I got so many extras on it, it took Harley Davidson 45 hours to add the special shit. Why? Because I can. That's right. I'm 50 years old, and what else am I gonna do? You know, I called Harlan and Zan, and Winnie, they were checking up on me. They were a little worried about me because I've been having a tough year. Yeah. I'm going through one of those AA divorces. Yeah, I hate it. 16 years. And I'm healing a broken heart. But I can tell you what I'm doing. I'm going to lots of meetings. I'm not drinking. And I haven't shot and killed anybody. So. Where was I? Have I gotten?
You were 12.
Oh, shit. And I bought a Harley when I was 50, so we got a lot of years to make up here. You know what it is? I just need to tell you what's going on so I can get on with the rest of them. Because, you know, I've got stuff happening in my life. I'm 24 years sober. I'm 52 years old. I'm going through a divorce. And I just spent, I just flew in from, Tucson because I was with my adopted family. You know, I have a family today, and I really wanted to dedicate this talk to my mom. For God's sake, this is paper towels. Jesus Christ. Yeah, more, no offense here. You know what, when I, my sponsor, Grady, I had this great sponsor, and on Sundays after the Sunday morning meeting, we used to go to her house and do makeup. Merle Norman. She used to teach her sponsees how to present themselves. I was somewhat sporty. They had all had nails out to here, and she goes, you know, you got a lot of potential. And she wanted to know what I used for a moisturizer. And I said, well, Vaseline Intensive. She goes, you mean you put on your face the same lotion you put on your ass? Who knew that your face had zones? I have zones on my face. I didn't know that you have zones on your face. And you have certain things you put here and certain things you put there. And, you know, I mean... It's a hard thing being a woman. You wouldn't believe how long it took me to put on that stuff that makes my eyes not so puffy. Under here, and then there's some other stuff you put up here to make your eyes not so puffy. Then you put on some stuff so that it keeps your eyes from being runny. I mean, you know, it was just easier when I wore flannel shirts, Wrangler jeans, and 2 6-packs of beer, and forget you, and, you know, a little Vaseline intensi. It's a done deal. You know, but you get sober, and they want you to become a lady. A lady with zones. So I want you to know, for your information, I have taken care of all the zones on my face this evening. And so that's what I'm going to talk to you about now, the zones on my face. Well, you know, I feel better already now that I got that divorce stuff out of the way and, got a little bit of that going. Yep. You know, I can tell you one thing. I'm going to be real with you no matter what. I'm going to be real. This is not a canned pitch. And I don't care if I get asked to talk anywhere else. Because I'm going to be authentically real with you tonight and tell you the truth. And I'm not going to, you know, blow smoke up your ass about what I know about the big book and all of that. Because I'm going to tell you something. If I can't tell you about my life and you can't see how life's showing up in my life, that the steps and the traditions of this program are woven into my life like the fabric on that tablecloth, then you're not listening. Because I want you to know that I am absolutely a miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I was in that first AA meeting, I thought that I thought my blackouts were just because I had a low IQ. Yeah, I had a low IQ. You know, my chocolate, I'm going to save it for later. Catherine got out of the hospital that she was in, you know, we're going to go back now to my stepmother, Catherine, the alcoholic that didn't know she was an alcoholic. Mary knew she was an alcoholic. Catherine was in denial. When they took her to the San Jose General Hospital in San Jose, and they said that she had a nervous breakdown. She didn't have any, they didn't talk about alcoholism. She had a nervous breakdown, and predominantly because I was in the home with her. I'm a powerful kid, let me tell you. I'm powerful. They put her in the nut hut, and she made ashtrays. Little ashtrays. We went to visit her, and she'd made these nice little ashtrays. Never once talked about her alcoholism, but they did talk about me not being in the home when she came home. So my dad took us to Chowchilla, California. Now, you remember, you've heard of Chowchilla, that's where they stole all those kids and put them in a bus and buried them? It doesn't matter, who cares? Anyhow, they took us to Chowchilla, and I had never, in my whole life, I grew up in San Francisco, you know, I mean, by now I'm 12, 13 years old, and I want to marry somebody in the Mexican mafia. You know, I want to have a lime green 64 Chevy. You know, the kind with the little dogs in the back that go like this, right? Those are reachable and attainable goals. But what they did is they took me to Chowchilla to these people that were identified themselves as Okies. I didn't know what Okies were. They said, well, we're Okies. Really? And so we got to this little house on road 22 and a half out in Chowchilla. There's nothing out there. They just start naming, giving roads numbers. And we drove up to this little shack, and the only thing holding this house up was this big ivy bush, right? Yes, great big gigantic ivy was like holding this house up, and I saw it in the daylight, and we went in there, and there was this young girl in there, and her name was Shannon. And Shannon was watching Hee Haw. Hee Haw. This country western show called Hee Haw. There was like 5 kids supposedly there. My brother had gone the week before. I had ran off and got picked up by the police. You know, one of those little things. At any rate, I said, well, where is everybody? And she says, well, they've all gone a-frogging. Gone a-frogging. I'm like, wonder what that is. And I said, well, how long does Gone to Frogging take? And she goes, they're out in Fireball, and they found a place where they got frog legs with thighs this big. Big thighs. And after this weekend, next weekend, we're going to have us an okra and frog leg fry. And I'm thinking, is she saying they're going to eat frogs? I'm like, you know, God has had a sense of humor in my life, but I mean, he's taking it to the extreme now, don't you think? I said to my dad, why don't you get some hamburger and I'll make these people some tacos. And what happened is my dad left to go back to take Catherine, to take care of Catherine, and what happened is Catherine got on the airplane 2 days later and flew to Los Angeles and got off the plane in Los Angeles and went into the women's bathroom and sat down on a toilet and shot and killed herself, just like my mother. So my dad has really had, you know, his alcoholism has taken him to the places that, you know, my birth father went to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1948. My mother died in 1958, and Catherine committed suicide in 1968. But I want you to know that I never gave up on my dad. Never gave up on my dad. My dad's 83 years old, and he's going to a noon meeting in Bakersfield, California. You know, I had to set a boundary with my dad, because I, you know, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and working these steps, you know, my dad wasn't a very great dad, but he's my dad. He was a man that he gave me life. And see, I was taught that if you work these steps, that the healing comes in the forgiveness, and that resentment sets off the sunlight of the spirit. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody has to forgive their parents, but I had to forgive mine. And I've, you know, worked the steps diligently on that. And I started spending time with my birth father over the years. And he used to want to be with me and tell me what a bad dad he is. Because when he got in my presence, he would feel bad. And I said, you know, Dad, I want to be able to be with you, but when I'm with you, what I want you to know is we don't get to talk about my childhood. Because, you know, you're right. I didn't have a great childhood. And I told him this when I was 48 years old. I'm 48 years old, and my childhood has been over for a long time. And I am the extraordinary woman I am today, really based on the fact that you weren't a very good dad. Because you weren't a very good dad, I lived the life that I lived, that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that our past becomes our greatest asset. And I am a survivor, Dad. No matter where you put me, I will survive. So I want you to know that I'm an extraordinary woman who has extraordinary talents because you weren't the greatest dad. So thanks. But we don't get to talk about it anymore, and I wish you'd work the steps on it. But that's really none of my business. He called me 2 months ago and said he's working on his first four step. I said, yahoo! I didn't say that exactly. I said, that's great, Dad. It's really great, because it's really none of my business, is it? You know, my brother who took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Yeah, he gave me the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, and 6 years later was sentenced to 40 years of hard time in Deer Lodge, Montana. Yeah. So if you're new here, you know, just stay here. Just stay here. You know, my little brother took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He did 16 years in the penitentiary in Montana. He was released in 2000. And I want to talk to you about this powerful disease called alcoholism. The only requirement for my brother to stay out of prison is not to drink. I want you to know that on January the 18th of 2008, my brother will have a year. Wow. 1 year. Now do the math. He's been out of prison since 2000. I got a call from my brother at the end of January of last year, and he was in jail. You know why he was in jail? Because he doesn't go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had a great job, and he bought a piece of property in Alberton, Montana, and wasn't around where there were any meetings. Got lonely one day. His best thinking is that he'll go to the bar in Alberton, have a drink. Now, his parole officer told him not to drink in Alberton, because, you know, my brother drinks, he can go back and do the rest of his time. Now, you think that that would be a motivating factor to keep him from going to a bar, wouldn't you? Uh-uh. Not only did he go to the bar, he went to the bar where the probation officer's niece was a bartender. Cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient. And he called me and said, "Sis, what am I going to do?" And I said, "I guess you're going to do what everybody else does, and I hope you get to your knees and you ask God to you know, give you the help that you're going to need to get out of this one, brother. Because I don't know what it's going to take for you not to drink." He goes, "I don't know why I took you to your first meeting and I can't do those steps and I don't go to meetings." And I said, "You know, I don't know either. But I can tell you one thing, you and Dad are a really big motivating factor in my life." And by the grace of God, and, you know, some people wrote some letters and everything else, and my brother was able to not have to go back to prison. And I want you to know that he just finished his first fourth step. So what I can tell you, if you're new, and this is a family disease, is that you just keep going to those meetings, and great, wonderful things will come to pass in your life. You know, I got to you, and I couldn't read or write. I was told, and, you know, in Chowchilla, where I was sent to that place, you know, I was put in foster care. My dad, after Catherine committed suicide, my dad just went away. You know, he just went away. So I was put in the foster care system over there, and I was in various foster homes over there, and, you know, the family that I just stayed, that I just left in Tucson, is my adopted family. They're not my real family. And my mother's, her name is Barbara Wood, and she's married to a man by the name of Jim Wood. And they love me like their own. You know, my mom, who, she's went through me going to treatment. She's gone through all of that with me. And I'm not her own, I'm not a real kid, but she stood by me through all of that. And, you know, my dad, he's got dementia, and I was staying with my mom and dad in their hotel room, and my dad got out. I mean, I just went downstairs to get some coffee, and my dad got out, and we lost my dad at the hotel, and my mom was freaked out. And, you know, I want you to know that it was because of Alcoholics Anonymous and my being present and a responsible daughter that I was able to be there for my mom. And be with her on Christmas Day when that was happening, right? So those are the things that you get to do. I don't know why I'm talking about that, but it's because it just happened. It's important in my life. And I don't know, geez, awfully serious in this room right now. You know, I just kind of jumped all around tonight, didn't I? Well, let me tell you, my last drunk was in a place called the Wagon Wheel. I love to tell this story, because I'd been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the old ladies in AA used to say, "You know, Edie, you can quit drinking any time. You don't have to go and gather any more of those yets." Now it's gathering yets. And, you know, I came out of this blackout with the ugliest man I'd ever seen in my life driving my car. Oh my God, I looked over at this guy and I thought, for Christ's sakes, that's gotta be a yet. I mean, those old ladies in AA are right, for God's sakes. You know, it was in the middle of summer, it was like August, and his big old fat belly was on his thighs, and he had, you know, heat blisters or heat pimples or something, you know, and he had on a Levi jacket with arms cut out. And, you know, by the time I was 10 years old, I could tell by your tattoos if you did county time, state time, federal time. He did a lot of county time. You know, that's when you're doing that body check, wondering if you've been intimate. And there's movement in the back seat. And I looked over there, and there's a girl, a young woman. It was, late 70s, early, late 70s, early. And when the boob tube was a big hit, tube top. And, remember those little chingadera things, your little tube top, boob tube, something tube. And she had a bad tattoo coming out the top. I found out later it was the attempt of the Hales Angel on a Harley Davidson Eagle, bad attempt. But you look around and you think, oh Christ, how do I get myself in these predicaments? God almighty, I gotta quit drinking. So they say to me that we're going to Reno to buy drugs with my money. These are not the kind of people you say, I've changed my mind. I think, well, I can open up the glove compartment. I know I've got AA chips in there. Used to be this great bar in Modesto you could take your chip to and they'd give you a free drink. My sponsor, Grady, said, Edie, if you drill holes in those chips of yours, you'd have a concho belt to go around you twice. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that I just never quit coming here. I just never quit coming here. What I did is I used to carry AA numbers in the top of my Wranglers, and what I decided to do that night was just go get done. You know how you think, well, you can't get out of this predicament, and you're already drunk. So why don't you just go drink as much as you can drink and do as much as you can do and then go and call those people in AA and go to treatment? Because they never said 90 meetings in 90 days. They used to say treatment. So, I don't know how long it was this drunk was, but I came to in this house, and there was nobody home. There was, and I want you to know, if you knew, that God always took care of me. There was a little bit of coffee left in the coffee pot. These people obviously had a job. I was sleeping on the couch. I thought, man, I have got to call somebody. And in the top of my Wranglers was a woman by the name of Mary S. And I just picked up the phone and I dialed the phone and she answered. And I said, Mary, this is Edie. I don't know if you... Oh, honey, we were just talking about you down at the Turlock group. How are you? When you call people in AA, they always ask you questions. And I said, well, I'm not doing so good. And she goes, what's going on? I said, well, I'm just ready to stop. I'm ready to go to treatment. And she goes, well, here comes another question. Well, where are you? Damn it. I said, well, I don't know where I'm at. But, these people, I don't know where they're, I don't know where I'm at. And she goes, well, can you find some mail? So I go over, I found a TV guide and it said I was on Tully Road in Modesto, California. She goes, I know right where that is. I'll come and get you. And I don't remember her coming and getting me. I don't remember her picking me up. But I want you to know that I woke up 3 days later, in Scenic General Hospital in a detox ward called Reality. It's really called Reality and it's still there. I had on sponge slippers. I had on Stanislaus County pajamas and a robe that somebody who had rolled those bad roll-you-up cigarettes had burned all kinds of holes in it. I looked over at this guy on this couch that I was sitting next to, one of those couches that somebody donated that they have to pull you up out of? He had like three teeth and he was rolling a cigarette. And he was making me sick watching him roll that cigarette. I looked over at him and I said, where are we? And he looked at me and he says, you're in detox. And I thought, for Christ's sakes, I'm in the Carpenters Union. I've got health insurance. For God's sakes, I can get better. Somebody's made, how does this happen? So I stood up and I put my robe together the best I could, and I walked up to this door, and I knocked on this door because I was going to get this straightened out. And this guy buzzed me in. His name was Hank Bagby. He says, well, what can I do for you, young lady? And I said, well, there's been a mistake. There's been a big mistake. I'm a drug addict, and I think these people out here are alcoholics. I'm in the Carpenters Union, and I have health insurance. Blue Shield health insurance. He says, that's good, we'll charge you. And I started to tell him my tale of woe. You know, that there's been a big mistake. You know, I'm not an alcoholic. I grew up with a woman that was an alcoholic. I know what a woman alcoholic looks like because I had lived with that woman, Mary, from the time I could remember. And in my mind's eye, I had a picture of what a woman alcoholic was and what a woman alcoholic would do, and that wasn't me. And I started telling him my tale of woe, and he looked at me and he goes, you know, you've been with us for 3 days, and you've been really, really sick, and we've had to give you medications for your detox. He goes, how about you do this, honey? How about you give the program down the street 28 days, and at the end of that, we'll give you back your wonderful life. You know, I thought that was probably a pretty good idea, because I don't know about any of you, but I was tired. So I went through the 28-day program, but first of all, what I did is I went and got in the bathroom, and I got on my knees, and the first time I ever got on my knees, and I said to God, I don't know if you're there, but I want you to know that I don't want to die like my mom. I don't want to die like Mary, and I don't want to die like Catherine. So if you just give me some help, I'll do this deal. And you know, after 48 days, they said, you know, Edie, you got to go. You know, and I had gone to, they took us over in like a little retard bus over to Santa Clara. And I heard this woman speak. You know, she got up at the podium, and I knew I needed a sponsor, and this woman got up to the podium, and she was one of those beautiful people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was fixing to get drunk again. You know how you know you're fixing to get drunk? You got a bad attitude, taking everybody's inventory, don't want to hear anything anybody has to say, and everything they have to say is just a bunch of shit anyhow. It's kind of how you know you're going to drink again. Sitting in the back of the room in my sunglasses, and here comes one of those beautiful people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she got up there, and now I'm going to cuss. I'm going to let you know I'm getting ready to cuss. Because I have to cuss because I just have to. Because this is how I knew. You know, there's certain people that speak to your listening, and she got up there, and she said all those nice things, and then she leaned into the microphone and said, I don't know about any of you MFers. I just can't do it. But I perked up from the back and I said, I bet she can sponsor me. God darn, there's a real person in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, you know, I mean, it's like I was scared to death of that fourth step. You know, all that stuff, you have to tell the truth. You know, I was in that program for 48 days and never once told the truth. I'm a liar, cheat, and a thief. I don't know about any of you, but when I got here, my most natural thing for me to do is to lie. I said my mom had a little dress shop, my dad was a retired lieutenant colonel, I had four brothers and sisters, and I had myself a fine little life down there in Atwater. Never once told the truth, because I had so much shame. I had so much shame about my life and where I'd come from, you know? And so when I heard Grady, I said, I moved to Sacramento, California, hunted her down, and said, you got to be my sponsor. And she said, really? Well, okay. And you know, it was kind of like I was a stalker. And she gave me an assignment, and I started working the steps. But what happened is she asked me how long sober I was. And I said, you know how they do that in AA? They ask you questions. And I wanted her to be my sponsor so bad, and my most natural thing to do is when my lips are moving as I'm lying, I said, well, I got 6 months. Because I was afraid if I didn't, she wouldn't take me. You know how that thinking goes? And so they add an AA. Yeah. So they gave me a cake for a year. I got high heels on, I about fell off this thing just now. I do, look at these high heels I have on. It's a long ways from cowboy boots. Anyhow, Grady.
Your birthday cake.
I got a cake. I didn't deserve it. I lied. And I got up to the podium and I said, you know, I haven't done a thing to earn this. And 3 days later, I was in the medical center because I couldn't stand the fact that I had lied to my home group. I couldn't tell the truth, and I was at UC Davis Medical Center, strapped to a gurney with IVs in my arms and hoses up my nose, and at the end of the gurney was my adopted sister, and they were stabilizing me because I had OD'd on alcohol and some drugs. And as they were stabilizing me, and they got me, like, to a place where I was okay, they asked me what had happened. And I looked at him and said, I had a bad batch of potato salad. And my sister at the end of the gurney said, she's an addict, alcoholic, she can't get sober, she's a retread in AA. And they said, I have to go to Al-Anon because she's just going to die. I'm like, oh my God, these dramatic people in my life. The doctor said, is this true? And I said, yeah. And he says, oh, you know, and then they turned to my sister and said, is she allergic to anything? And I looked at the doctor, I said, yeah, just don't give me anything I'll want more of, because you're not going to have enough. And anyhow, that was on July the 10th, 1983, and the next day I went to my home group and that evening, and from that day to this, I've not taken anything or done anything. I have been clean and sober for all those years because I was willing to be teachable. I was willing to do what Grady told me to do. I was willing to go in there after Thursday night meeting and get on the floor and do the third step prayer with those 18 women that she sponsored at our home group. I was willing to go get all the women at the recovery houses and do the things that I was told to do. I was willing to do my first four step and tell the truth. And, you know, talk about how much shame I had about the fact that I couldn't read or write, and I didn't want anybody to know. She goes, honey, I know you're a hell of a lot smarter than that, and what I want you to know is, to this day, I don't write very well, I don't spell very well, but I want you to know I'm highly native intelligent. And I was 3 years sober, they said, you know, Edie, you ought to get a job. And, you know, what I did is, this guy came to me at my home group and said, you know, the state of California is hiring, the architect's office is hiring project managers for the prison system, and why don't you apply for it? And so the women in Alcoholics Anonymous helped me fill out the forms and turn in an application, and I got this letter from the state. You know, you get these letters, official letters, you take them to your home group and they interpret them for you. So I got this important letter, I took it to my home group, and they said, well, you got to take this test, Edie. And I said, oh, okay. So, you know, two longtime sober women of Alcoholics Anonymous delivered me to the community center in Sacramento, and I went in and I took this test. It was a four-hour test, and I didn't get everything finished, but I completed as much as I could, and I walked out that door, and I mean to tell you, I felt better because at least I completed the process. I didn't care whether or not I got the job, but I did the footwork. That's what I said, you shoot for the moon and you land in the stars. You know, 6 weeks later, I got a letter. One of those other letters you have to take to your home group and get interpreted, right? Because it looked like I got a job. So I took that in there and they said that I was in the top 10% of the people that were tested and I was to be hired. I'm like, wow. You know, and then I, you know, I got to meet these people. I was the first woman ever hired to do industrial inspection for the state architect's office in 1985 in California. I mean, it's a long ways from where I come from. You know, and I was working down there on this prison, and what I want you to know is that you come here and you do the deal and you work the steps and then you go out and you practice life, right? And I was so excited about, can you imagine how excited I was about this job? I was so excited. And I got on this job, and the first day I was there, they gave me to this guy by the name of Al. Oh, Al. Al had been a building inspector for 28 years. He was so significant, he wore his hard hat inside the car. And as we were driving down to the job site, he said, well, we knew those minorities were going to come. Now, I'm going to say something, and the reason I'm going to say it is I want you to get the true essence of Al, but I want you to get the true essence of how Alcoholics Anonymous showed up in my life. Because there's a junkyard dog that lives inside of me. There's a wild little animal that came to Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't have any self-respect for myself or you. And OL said, yeah, we knew those minority would come, we just didn't know when they were going to get here. So I thought, well, I must be one of them. And I said, well, what other minorities are going to come besides me? Now, don't get offended, but I got to tell you exactly what he said so you get the true essence of Al. He said, we got two niggers, an Indian, and a cunt coming. Now we're just waiting on the two niggers and the Indian. And if you're new, this is where you practice the principles of the program. Because there's a junkyard dog that lives inside of me that had some things that I wanted to say. But in that moment, I just shut my eyes, and I know that what came out of my mouth was absolutely channeled by God. Because I looked at Al and I said, you must have some resistance in my being here. But it's not okay that you ever talk to me like that again. That's Alcoholics Anonymous talking through me. It's not the woman that walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what I want you to know is that, you know, I have a great life. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't on that job very long before I applied for a job at UC Davis. UC Davis, same place that I was strapped down in 1983, right? I applied for this job, and I filled out the application, and I turned it in, and I got one of those letters, and by now I can interpret the same letter, and it said that I had to go to the University of California, Davis, in Davis, and I was going to be interviewed. And I got there, you know, a half an hour before I was supposed to be interviewed, and they gave me the job description. The job description was 8 pages. It also identified the fact that I'd have a budget of over $40 million. I looked at that, and I read that job description, and said, oh boy, there'd been a big mistake here. But I'm dressed, I'll just do the rest. And so I went into the interview and they asked me all these questions and I was the best sober woman I could be. And I answered all the questions and I left, and about 6 weeks later I got one of those letters and they hired me. They hired me at UC Davis to be an inspector planner estimator. I went to work at UC Davis, the same place that was my last drunk, right? I was there 5 years, and there was this job that came up as superintendent. I said, well, I think I'll apply for that. Why not? Shoot for the moon, land in the stars. Fill, you know, just whatever it is you're afraid of, go for it. See what God's intentions is. One of my favorite prayers is, let God just let me see the big picture of my life. You know, I was interviewed for this job, and it was one of those interviews where it's like as long as from here to that man over there, and you could see all these people with suits, reflection in the table. They asked me all kinds of really important questions, and the last question was the most important question. They said, so Edie, you know, if you're the successful candidate in this position, you'll be working with the academic departments. Is there anything that you do outside of in the community that gives back to your community? I thought, oh, shit. Well, I thought in my mind, I can't tell them I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, they won't hire me. And in the same thought, I thought if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't even be here. So I looked at him and thanked him for the opportunity to have had this interview, and I told him I'm a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I take meetings of H&I we go to San Quentin and Folsom and those prisons in that area, and I was part of that committee for a long, long time. And they said, oh, really? You know, and they go, well, what's it like? And I said, well, you know, we have to sign a thing of no hostage clause. That means that when you go there, that if they decide to keep you, that they won't bargain for you. Oh, really? Well, how does that work? I said, it's kind of like bacon and eggs. One's committed and one's involved. Bacon and eggs. A pig had to die. Chicken just laid an egg. They didn't get it either. It was my sponsor that talked to me about being committed or involved. You know, either you're committed or you're involved. It's like bacon and eggs. And I'm like, really? Oh, bacon and eggs. What's that? Well, the pig had to die, baby. The pig had to die. So now you know. I explained it to them, they laughed too. And you know what happened is, I didn't think I was going to get the job. 3 days later, I got called up to the chancellor's office, and guess what? They gave me the job. Now, is that amazing? That's damn amazing. For a girl like me, who got to you in a pair of flannel a pair of Wrangler jeans and flannel shirts and cowboy boots who use Vaseline Intensive on her butt and her face, too. I can tell you that I've had great accomplishments and I've had great loss. You know, my first sponsor I lost in 2000. And you know that job, I was a superintendent at UC Davis for 10 years. And in 1983, I had a grievance. I had somebody file a grievance against me. I mean, not in 83, in 2003. No, 2004, they filed this grievance against me. And I want you to know that on November the 3rd in 2004, I was fired from that job. Yeah, do you think I'm proud of telling you that? I couldn't believe it. I was, you know, and I'm not going to go into it. It was a highly political situation, but I was fired. So, lost my job, lost my relationship, my dad's in dementia, I'm speaking in Las Vegas, right? And a headhunter comes to me and I've been hired by a company by the name of Fleur. I'm going to Russia in 3 weeks. So what I want you to know is you know, you never know what God's plan is. And so the truth of the matter is that I'm 52 years old, I'm reinventing my life, and I'm going to be okay. Because I go to lots of meetings, I sponsor women, and I do what I'm told in Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what I need to do to stay alive. So I want you to know that where are you going? I'm getting ready to stop. I've talked about, God damn, Sherry, I'm just getting ready to go. You gotta pee that bad. Anyhow, I want you to know it's been an honor and a privilege to be with you. You know, and an old Indian elder used to say, you know, the longest journey we will ever take is from our mind to our heart. And I was able to take that journey with you tonight. Thank you so much.